Hi there. Welcome to Sample Space. This is a podcast where we try to highlight some good ideas in machine learning, and we try to put an emphasis on ideas that might otherwise be overlooked. My name is Vincent, and I'll be your host. In this episode, I'll be talking to Adrian Jalali. He's one of the core maintainers of scikit-learn, but he's also been working on this effort to make models a bit more safe to deploy. If you've been using machine learning in Python, you might have heard of these pickle files that you need to deploy your machine learning model. And there are some security concerns that come with that. There's a new package that he's been working on called Scops that tries to address some of these issues. And while we will be spending some time talking about that, we're also going to discuss what it's like to be a maintainer of one of the most popular Python packages in machine learning. It's a really interesting conversation, and I really hope you enjoy it. Hi, Adrian.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. We are about to do a little bit of an interview, but it might also be good to acknowledge to people listening, we are colleagues. So it might sound a bit informal, but that's because we are colleagues and, you know, we exchange ideas. And at some point we figured there's just some ideas that needed to be shared when it comes to model safety and production and stuff. But before getting to all that, because I also know you a little bit, I figured it might be also fun to start talking a bit about how you got started with open source, because there's a couple of fun anecdotes there that I do think the world needs to kind of know about. So Adrian, because I happen to know the anecdote, how did you get started with this open source thing?
I started with open source before I knew what open source is. That was way before I seriously started with open source. I remember around, I was doing my master's, so it must have been around 2005, 2006, where, I come from Iran, and there we use the Persian calendar, which is different from the Gregorian calendar. And whenever there's a leap year, every now and then, there would be a mismatch, a permanent mismatch between the dates. And when I was doing my master's, that happened to my widget up there. And I was like, hey, this needs to be fixed. And the author told me, well, you can submit a patch. I did not understand what submit means or what patch means. But I had a Python script that I had copied from somewhere.
And this was a bug in your educational software or something, I take it? And
no,
you wanted to just get that patched?
No, it was in the widget that we all would have in Iran up there to show us the date, which would convert the Gregorian calendar date of the laptop to the Persian date.
Ah, so it was like the operating system level kind of a buggy thing, I suppose.
Yeah, kind of a desktop environment level kind of bug, not the OS level, because none of the OS would actually support that calendar. We just had a widget which would take the Western calendar and it would convert it to the Iranian calendar. So I emailed the patch, and then, I don't know, a couple of months later, I saw that there's a release, and I'm one of the co-authors of this new release. I was like, oh, that's cool.
Your first PR was over email then?
Yes. That was before Git was a thing.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's obvious. So that was part of the anecdote I didn't know, actually. But okay, cool. So your first PR was an email, but then things did take off from there, I think.
Yeah, I was like, this is open source. This is nice. And it was on the back of my mind. And then fast forward years later, in 2012, I started to do Python. And 2 years after that, I was a little bit more proficient in Python, and I noticed an issue in scikit-learn. This was 2014, where the issue was that NumPy had deprecated indexing using floating point number. Up until that point, you could say an array, and then the index would be a floating point value. As long as it was a proper number, as in an integer, it would accept it. And scikit-learn had a piece of code that was figuring out some indices and passing those indices to NumPy, but it was figuring out those indices by dividing something by two. And that divide by two in Python, if you have one slash, it gives you a floating point number. If you have two slashes, it gives you integers. So the fix was to add a slash beside that existing slash. And that was my first PR to scikit-learn.
There you go. So that, and that's also what I remember from our first conversation about this topic.
Yeah.
Your first PR to Python or like a big Python project was a one character pull request in this realm.
Yeah. And then I was, fasting forward years later, there was a PyData Berlin conference, and we had this tradition of having a few free slots and deciding kind of on the spot what to do for those slots. And for that particular slot, we decided to talk about my first open source contribution, or how to do your first open source contributions. And there it was, me and Matti, another PyData contributor back then.
Yeah, I remember Matti. He was a chair for PyData Berlin, I think, for a few years, right?
For a while, yeah. And we talked about our open source stuff. And back then, what I had been doing for a while was to learn Elasticsearch, because I was in a consulting company and we got a gig to go teach Elasticsearch. And then we had to learn it to be able to go to teach it. And I started to go through the documentation. And going through the documentation, I figured out a lot of punctuation issues or grammar issues, like little tiny fixes. I would submit a bunch of PRs to Elasticsearch documentation and they would like very quickly get approved. So that was the talk. Like when we talked about it, I was like, hey, like your contributions really don't have to be hard. The barrier to entry can be really low. After that talk, somehow I was extremely motivated to do serious open source. And I had a lot of time at hand. So I started going to find a project where I could contribute. The first one I found was TensorFlow. Back then I was doing a little bit of TensorFlow. I started to try to contribute there very naively. And then realizing nobody cares about my contributions because this is more of a Google product that every now and then they dump whatever new version they have. It's not a community-led project. So I was disappointed and I moved to scikit-learn. I found an issue where we had to add a teeny tiny example on the doc string of each class to say how this could be used in very simple ways. And I started opening pull requests for that, 20, 30 of them. And I got lucky that there were two maintainers at the time on scikit-learn very patiently mentoring me on those. The first few ones were definitely a lot of work. And then I got better at the game. And I stayed on the project my weekends, my evenings. It was very rewarding. And about 6 months later, on a December morning, I woke up to an email asking if I want to be a core developer for scikit-learn. I was like, hell yeah. Oh, that sounds cool. And 2-3 months later, I was asked if I want to take on a job doing scikit-learn full-time. So that completely changed my career from that point on.
Sweet. So how much time was it between when you decided to do some PRs for scikit-learn until you got like the maintainer email?
About 6 months.
Yeah, about half a year. Okay, so definitely a bit of an incubation period, but it's also not that ridiculously long or anything. I think half a year is still like pretty quick.
It depends on how much time you put in it.
Sure. Like if you do one PR a month, that's different than when you do 20 doc PRs, which you seem to have done. So one thing I'm wondering just a bit, because you've been a scikit-learn core maintainer for a while now, like more than 5 years.
Yeah, this story was 2018.
Yeah, exactly. So we're around the 5 year mark. Just out of curiosity, because scikit-learn is a pretty big project, like in terms of usage, like millions of downloads a month. So I can imagine there's like a little bit of a burden of responsibility in the back of your mind. And I can also imagine that there were things that you realized more because you're a maintainer now than stuff that you realized when earlier on you were just doing a few PRs now and then. If you were to look back and sort of think, well, this was unexpected, but in hindsight, it makes sense. Like what's kind of the interesting lesson from the maintainer's perspective, you think, that you've learned?
Especially when you start at the beginning, it is very rewarding, but that reward is the same kind of reward that gets you addicted on substances.
A quick hit kind of a feeling.
Yeah. Every time, like when you start, every review you get is extremely rewarding. Every time that your a PR or pull request gets merged, it's extremely rewarding. So you keep doing it. You don't have evenings. I didn't have evenings. I didn't have weekends. All the free time that I had was going into the project. And at some point, you need to realize that you need to get a life.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you cannot go on for a long time. you will get burnt out. But it is really hard to do that because we have a lot of contributors who are volunteers, which means by definition, they only have time when they're not working, which is the time that we probably also don't want to work. But if you want to keep them engaged, you need to be responding to them in a timely manner, which means you kind of end up working a little bit on your weekends and on your evenings. Sometimes I find myself, I really try hard not to do that, but it's weekend, I'm in a social gathering, I take a break to take some air, I end up looking on my GitHub notifications and sorting them out and like ignoring, unsubscribing from the ones that I don't care about, but which means I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
It is really hard to completely disconnect.
Interesting. So I can imagine when you're just starting out, there's so much excitement because there's this feeling of, oh, I got something in this I could learn. I rule. And then, oh, I want to have that feeling again. So you go for the next PR and kind of the next one. But then as you kind of grow older and wiser, I suppose, and when you're the maintainer, you actually recognize that that behavior has something that is, I don't know if toxic is the right word, but that you got to be careful with that feeling. Like that excitement is
Not toxic, but it hurts you.
Yeah.
It is toxic for yourself, not for others. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the risk of overdoing it is something that you become more aware of at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, like at this point, when I look at people's GitHub profiles, if I see that they have no empty days, that is not a positive thing for me. Like when I see that, I'm like, oh, like you do not have a life. Like I'm not, there is a good chance you might be burnt out. And if you're burnt out, it might not be pleasant to work with you.
Yeah, it's a tricky balance, I can imagine as well. Because if you've got like, let's say the beginner who is doing really good work on documentation, let's say, and they're super eager to learn, you do want to motivate them in a way,
yes,
just not too much.
Yeah,
and that is something you're going to be sort of aware of when you're more of a maintainer, I suppose. That's what I can imagine. Something, yeah, and I can also imagine that's something that's kind of hard to expect up front, that's going to be part of it.
Yeah. But it is a lot harder than... sometimes one thing I miss from the old days of not doing open source is the peace of mind when I left work.
Yeah, the off switch.
Yeah, I do not have an off switch.
Yeah. Similarly, like I've moved from Amsterdam to a town that's between Amsterdam and the beach. And one thing I definitely appreciate is this town has a pretty good off switch. Like there's way less people here. So when I close the lid on the laptop, I can go outside. There's not too many people and life is just kind of calm. One thing about open source is because it's so prevalent and there's always another issue popping up, you can really keep on doing it indefinitely on a large project like scikit-learn if you really wanted to. There's no natural off switch.
Yeah.
I maintain some packages as well, and yeah, I get some issues in, but that's like on a twice a month basis, maybe. A bit of a different ball game than what scikit-learn's got to deal with.
Yeah, no, I remember last week I was so we had a holiday on Thursday in Germany, and I took Friday off. So from Wednesday to Monday, my notification was up from about 17 to about 70.
Yeah. It keeps on piling. I guess perhaps somewhat related to this, but something I do wonder. A buddy of mine is a painter. And what's really cool about his job is he goes to a house, he paints something, and then at the end of the day, he can look at it and go, this looks nice now. I've done my work. And, you know, a friend of mine can go home. Like, you get that sort of, okay, I've accomplished something within a day, and that's just kind of nice. Obviously it's kind of hard to get that with scikit-learn because some of these features really need to be double checked and, you know, little numerical details can really matter. And you got to think about that twice sometimes. Is that also a feeling you've noticed as well? That like, if you want to get a sense of accomplishments from scikit-learn, you also kind of have to let that short-term gratification go. Is that also something you've noticed?
In a way, maybe, at least for me, it has been the case that the more senior or knowledgeable you become on such a project, then the tasks that you pick up are the harder because you know the other stuff like a lot of other people can do as well. You do little stuff, but the little stuff start not to matter so much to you anymore. Because you know, like, well, this thing needed to happen. I did it, sure, but like, it's not, I don't get that much reward from it. the projects that do feel very rewarding for me are, like, they take time. And the last one that I worked on was this metadata routing in scikit-learn that took, I was involved with it for about 4 years. And then now it's in. It's extremely rewarding. I just had a Pylades talk in Berlin last night about it. It does feel nice, but there was a time, like at least the last year or so of my heavy work on that feature, there was not much that you could see on the repository happening from my side because my work was so focused on that single thing, but it was so hard to get that single thing in. But now that it has happened, I'm so quite happy.
Yeah, oh, that's also a fun way to maybe look at it. Like it's kind of like building a house. Like, yeah, you can be a painter and you can be done in the day, but it can also be more rewarding when you actually start with the foundation and see it sort of through all the end. And yeah, it's a lot of work and it's tougher in a way, but by the end, you also get like a larger sense of accomplishment. That's also a difference when you're a core maintainer sometimes, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I guess like a final question that I'm curious about when it comes to maintaining, right? Like, so scikit-learn is different than other projects because it's a machine learning thing, right? So there's already, that makes it different than Django. Like there's different concerns and different skill sets that people need and maybe even a different PhD. But I can also imagine that there's different cultures in terms of maintaining something. And I'm picking Django because I think Django is also, you know, pretty well organized and mature as an organization around an open source project. But at some point, when you look at an open source project, you also got to mention words like community and culture and stuff like that. Just out of curiosity, is that something that also becomes more of your day-to-day concern as you become sort of more and more of a core maintainer? Or is it something that is formed naturally? What's your perspective on that? Just out of curiosity.
I don't think it comes naturally to everybody. I don't think it has to be on everybody's mind. It is for me. It is important to me that we have a good community. I also think if you want to maintain a healthy and you want to maintain a growing community, you have to have a sort of community that is welcoming. Otherwise, you're going to get a very different kind of people who enter your community. And like once a few toxic people enter, that very quickly spreads. And people who do not like those behaviors, they leave very quickly. So there's definitely a lot of work we do on that front. For example, if you care about the diversity of contributions in your project, that is a lot of work. I remember traveling to Nairobi for a weekend sprint, mentoring people, and then coming back to Berlin. I was there just for the weekend. We have done a lot of sprints with Pylades, Pylades Paris, Pylades Berlin, and Amsterdam did recently one. There is a lot of work we do that the reward from them is very long term. As in, you need to be doing that for 2, 3, 4 years before it starts showing some rewards for your community that you notice. So it is very easy to give up very quickly.
Yeah, and it's also one of these things where, I mean, even in your case, like you've been bitten by the TensorFlow thing where there wasn't necessarily someone there to sort of mentor you in, and you can kind of see what that does to the project. Like only the Google thing will happen with TensorFlow. And if you want to prevent that here, well, someone mentored you and then you probably have to mentor someone else because who knows, maybe after 10 years, you're going to do something else and someone else needs to kind of be able to step in. And that's not even mentioning all the, hey, new ideas also need to sort of pop in the open source project or otherwise it becomes stale. There's all sorts of concerns like that as well. But would you also say that part of the motivation for you personally is also the fact that you've been mentored in? Is that like something that helps or is it also something more intrinsic?
No, it wasn't just that. Somehow, it comes from my background that coming from an extremely poor family, it was very important for me to get help from people. And I always appreciated that. And I do understand somehow because of my own history, I do understand people who did not have the privilege, even, you know, privilege is a very multifaceted thing. They did not have the privilege that I had to go to the universities that I did at the end, and being a guy and just like feeling so natural in this space. So that kind of drives me.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, and I can also see an attitude like that is also kind of helpful to the project at large. Again, otherwise, I can also just imagine that you don't want scikit-learn to be a package that does one thing and one thing only and will only ever do one thing only and only this way, because, you know, the world is moving forward and scikit-learn needs to sort of chug along with it. That's it.
Yeah, it does bring the challenges that, like, when you have a new... you do want that diversity, but it is... also challenging. I personally enjoy that challenge because the new perspectives are, you know, kind of by definition a different perspective, which are different from you. And then you suddenly see this person that you enabled and they have ideas that are not your ideas. And you're like, well, I did want different ideas, but now their ideas are not the same as my ideas. What do I do with that now?
Yeah. You are going to open the stage for discussions, right? And it also means people will butt heads. So that, as long as that happens in a healthy way, it's in a healthy way. I do want to slightly pivot, though, because the reason I brought you into this little interview here is not just because of your work in open source as the scikit-learn maintainer, but also because at some point you decided that there was an issue that you wanted to address in the ecosystem at large. And you also decided that maybe the best way to go about it is to do sort of a separate package. And the joke that I'll make while introducing this is that you were looking at the ecosystem and then you said, boy, this is a pickle. Vincent made a joke. That said, we're going to talk about like security and machine learning stuff. And I think the best way to introduce it is to just ask you like, hey, Adrian, people used to use pickles a lot when dealing with scikit-learn models. What could go wrong there?
So to give a bit of an intro, pickle is how it is in Python. It is the standard way to save objects. You have some artifacts, you want to save them. How do you save them? You pickle them, because why not put things in salt? But then when you start doing that, at some point it became the standard way to save and load also machine learning models. The issue is not specific to machine learning. It is how people save and load objects in Python. Or if you have like, this is how also if you have a cluster and you want to send something from one node to the other node, usually what you would do is you just send that thing in the pickle format.
Yeah, it helps if you have some sort of format that you could theoretically write on disk, because if you can write it on disk, it's also a format that you can easily send over the network and then load it up from there. So I think some of these multi-core libraries also make a lot of use of pickle files for this reason.
I think Dask uses that heavily. And then, of course, we had Joblib, which was kind of, it didn't have to, but Joblib is also maintained by people who maintain scikit-learn. And it was the need, I guess. I'm not one of the maintainers of Joblib, and I haven't been involved with it like for as long as people like Olivier, another maintainer in scikit-learn. But when they started with Joblib, pickle was not as fast as it is now. So one of the motivations was to have something which is a lot faster. If you have large NumPy arrays inside your model, back then pickle would be pretty slow. These days with Protocol 5, which is like Python 3.8 plus, it is as fast. Still, pickle does not support memory mapping. If you have a bunch of processes reading the same file, Joblib does that memory mapping for you, putting things in shared memory. So it's like kind of nice. But as long as you're in single process space, your pickle would be as fast.
Yeah, and I think also Joblib, where it sits inside of scikit-learn land, it's basically the place where we are dealing with parallelizable algorithms sometimes, like grid search, and Joblib is kind of the puzzle piece that makes that easy. Yeah. And when you think about multi-core, you immediately also go, oh, okay, that also makes sense. We need some sort of serialization here, because again, potentially sending stuff over the wire to different machines, et cetera, et cetera.
And again, as long as you are pretty much, you are the one who's dumping something and loading that same thing, you trust yourself. And that's okay. The issue is when you start loading things that somebody else gave you.
So a pre-trained machine learning model, let's say.
For example. Yes. then that is the point where you realize, oh, Pickle by design is arbitrary code execution, which means when you get a pickle from somebody else and you load it, the act of loading runs whatever code is in that pickle file. So it is the same as running an exe file or any kind of executable on your machine.
This is a bit of a joke, but it's kind of like, what is a pickle? Well, it's basically running a .exe file with a side effect that you get a machine learning model.
True.
Sometimes this is kind of interesting about a pickle file. Like sometimes it is told to you as, oh, it's meant to load up a Python object, but there can be side effects. But in the case of security, the better way maybe to describe it is to say, oh, there's side effects, and the side effect is you get the loaded machine learning model.
Yeah, pretty much. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So you looked at this situation, I guess I would say. And this was when? Like, I think a few years ago, maybe two at this point-ish?
Yeah, I think it was 2 years ago. Back then, there was also the community started to realize that this might be an issue. The security community always knew. The Python maintainers always knew. Like, people who actually were dealing with Pickle, they knew that this is a terribly insecure way of persisting objects, but it is very convenient. And there would always be these disclaimers in the documentation that, hey, like, you really should trust the source if you're loading one. Nobody would read those disclaimers. And then I realized, well, this is a challenge. And my attitude to tech challenges is, you can always fix it. The question is, how much effort and time is it going to take?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we were at a conference, EuroSciPy conference in Basel, and I had a conversation with another maintainer, Gaël Varocco, about having an alternative to Pickle. And his position was like, no, by definition, Pickle is insecure. It doesn't matter how you create that, what kind of format you have, it has to be insecure to do its job.
And was that because we have scikit-learn objects that need to run Python functions? Like, was he worried about the most general case, or what was the full argument there?
Yeah, because Pickle can dump any kind of thing, and loading them would mean you have to run the constructor of an object, which means you're running code.
And also, if you want to do this and support third-party libraries, which could, in theory, really contain anything, like text embeddings in the kitchen sink, let's say, then you have to assume scikit-learn wants to support that. Therefore, we have to assume Pickle because we want to be super general. Therefore, Gail was worried that this was not going to fly well.
Yeah,
that was his concern. All right.
And a bit of background. The difference is if I have a C or C++ object and I want to dump it, I look at that piece of memory. I dump that piece of memory, and when I want to load it, I load it, and I tell my runtime that look at this piece of memory as if it was this object, and then you go on from that point. You don't run any code. You just dumped some binary code, you loaded some binary code. We don't do that in languages like Python. What you do is that you ask the object, okay, like, give me your state, and then you get that state, and somehow you write that down. And then when you want to load it, you load that state, and then you tell that same kind of object, you're like, well, can you give me an object that has this state? And it does that for you. So there is a bit of running code and negotiation with that object, which means you can put any kind of code you want in that piece of code that object has. But like, it is, the problem gets a lot worse than that, but this is the gist of it.
Right. And the main concern here is if you're some malicious person, then some of the side effect code that you can put in there is stuff like take everything on disk and send it to this server somewhere in who knows where.
Yeah.
And by the way, steal all the credentials, the bitcoins and whatnot. Those are sort of the situations that people are kind of afraid of. And Pickle does not save you there.
Yeah, basically. No. Talking about security, like, Pickle requires you anything that you're loading to be installed to be importable in your Python interpreter, which means whatever you're loading, you have to have the library installed that can load that thing. And if that malicious code is in one of those libraries, then that library is malicious. And if you have a malicious library in Python, you don't have to load anything to run malicious code, because there are other processes in Python through which you can run arbitrary code as the user runs Python process. Mm-hmm. Before you see, when you run Python, before you see that like that first
Python version line in your REPL, yeah.
Before that, there's a bunch of code running. So you could connect to a remote server as you run your Python. So it is important to note that we are not going to save people again, like from having malicious libraries installed in their machines. If they have that, they are
already. So then you're already syncing, basically. Yeah.
Yes. But then I took the challenge and I went and started working on it. And the result of that was what I liked to call SKOps. I was like, well, it's like some operations around SKLayer. And then everybody else started calling it SCOPs. So that's how we called SCOPs.
But and once someone pronounces it, you cannot take it back. That's
true. I kind of liked it. And I also didn't know that it's an evil character in some cartoon or some game that you pointed out when we were looking at logo options back then.
Oh, yeah. It's most of the time when I come up with let me put it this way. Most of the times whenever I sort of review a new package name, I just try to make sure it's not a Pokemon. And Scops was kind of in that domain, which is why I threw it into Google. And that's how I did end up finding out that one time that it was a bad character in some show, indeed, like some cartoon. but again, like, okay, if no stopping that. You're kind of stuck with that aspect of the story in a way. But okay, but you made this collection of tools for like operations in general. But I think in that package of all the tools that are sort of being mentioned there, I think there's like a little bit of a mention of model cards and there's like a couple of things. But the main thing that library offers as of right now is the ability to save scikit-learn things in a non-pickled way. I think that's like the main feature it offers currently.
Yeah, yeah. And it is like my related to the persistence in Scops, my most proud moment was when we got a CVE report and the CVE was not legit. Like the CVE was more
what is
like,
a CVE report, just for clarification?
It is, I don't remember what it stands for, but it basically means if somebody finds a security vulnerability in your library or in your system, they open a CVE report. At first, it's going to be private. They report it. If they're responsible, they report it to you. They give you time to fix it. And then later down the line, it will be public. So there are databases where you can go and be like, I want to deal with this package. Are there any vulnerabilities? And then those databases show you the existing vulnerabilities, or if there are some vulnerabilities that existed in the past that are fixed at some version. And then you can choose a version based on that.
And this is kind of like a service that if you are a regulated industry, something, something, finance, something, something, then you're going to take this stuff very seriously. If a service provider says, oh, we've got a CVE for this package on this particular version, then you can bet that that bank is not going to use that package. Kind of like the short summary. All right. Okay. So a report from that came in, and then?
And then the report was the fact that if the user, so when you load the difference from the user API point of view, the only difference between Joblib and Pickle and Scops.io is that in Scops, when you load, by default, it doesn't load because it tells you that there are all these objects here that I don't know. Mm-hmm. And it lists them. And by listing them, it doesn't, that is a major difference between that and Pickle, that figuring out what those things are does not require running any code.
Right. So initially, when you save something, you can try to load it. But when you load it, when you call the load function, initially it doesn't really load anything just yet. It just reports on stuff that it seems to find.
It fails, and it tells you that there are these things that I don't know. There are some scikit-learn and NumPy and SciPy stuff that we have set as already trusted. But if there are things that we don't know, we say, hey, these things exist there. We don't trust them. We don't know them. Do you?
Right.
And then you have to explicitly say, yes, I trust these things.
And then the things that you typically do trust, I suppose, are things like stored NumPy arrays on disk. Like that's a somewhat binary format that feels safe enough in a way. Like, would I be correct in sort of assuming that?
There's a point there because I'm glad you brought it up. NumPy By default, if you have dtype object, it uses pickle.
Interesting. Yeah.
So what we do, yes, we do save our arrays using the NumPy format, but we make sure that we do not save anything in with pickle. We tell NumPy do not use pickle. And if NumPy fails, we fall back to our own format, which is a lot more inefficient in terms of reading and writing, but it's not pickle. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it is the binary format that is not pickle. It's just a bunch of numbers or strings like saved on disk, and then you load them.
So but in terms of NumPy, if it's like an integer or a float or maybe a Boolean, right, like those kinds of arrays, those are kind of fine. But the moment that object is in there, you can't really guarantee anything anymore. So then you just raise all the flags, basically.
Then we fall back to the way that we would dump objects instead of allowing NumPy to fall back to pickle.
Makes sense. Okay, so then but then you read it in, and then you are able to sort of see, okay, these are the things I'm apparently loading in. And then as a user, you have to be kind of explicit and say, okay, yeah, this is within the range of expectations, so fine, let's do it. And otherwise, okay, so then...
We have the option, so the CVE is that we have the option that the user can say, I really do trust the source, I don't care what's in the file, just load it.
Right.
As in, you say, trusted is true, like, I trust everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then the CVE report says, well, your documentation mentions that, but if the user says trusted true, then I can run arbitrary code on the user's machine, which is true, but the user explicitly said they trust the source.
Yeah, so, okay, so there is an interesting thing there, right? So I can't imagine, there's a tricky thing here when it comes to explaining this tool, because if you communicate it's safer than pickle, which I think that's a claim you can make, then people might say, ooh, I can trust it blindly. Oh, because that's a nice feeling.
Yeah.
But there's also a bit of danger in that, right?
That's very true. It also, like, this conversation also makes me wonder if the user really does trust the source, they could just use pickle.
Well,
so maybe we want to remove that option.
Well, that's also where the discussion is kind of going towards. Like, you have to trust the source now. And there are things you can do around it such that you could trust the source more. Like, you could do things like have your own little database where you, I don't know, you hash your files, and that's like you're verifying that. There's also the things you can do around the safe machine learning state that might make it a bit safer. But the hard part here is if there's anything that's kind of custom, let's say you use a function transformer and you have a custom Python function in there, you are going to have to rely on some manner of trust.
Yeah,
I think that's it might be safer, but you're not completely out of the woods, even with this tool.
No, if what you see that is going to be loaded is something that you don't really understand, but you really want to load it, and you say like, "Yeah, I trust it," then it's not safe.
Yeah, and I guess like the main place where this is going to play a role, and I'll add it to the show notes. Like, there was a sort of an Ars Technica article about this a few months ago. So there's this place called Hugging Face that's sort of well known where people can sort of host their machine learning models. And this is sort of becoming a very prevalent issue for that platform, because if you're going to download a whole bunch of pre-trained models, in a way, that's great because people did effort and you didn't have to waste compute. So that's amazing. But if you're then going to start downloading a bunch of pickle files, that does really open up the floodgates in terms of like, okay, can I trust this source? Because I may be downloading a bunch of files and running some arbitrary code in my machine. And the newspaper article will actually share some stories where there was definitely some malicious code.
Yeah, so, yeah. There was also, there like in the deep learning space, there has also been a bunch of effort to move away from pickle. I think TensorFlow very early on had its own format.
Mm-hmm.
PyTorch under the hood was using pickle. Last I checked was about a year ago. There were some very nice efforts to move away from that.
The SafeTensors one comes to mind. Is that
no? No, SafeTensors was a different one. SafeTensors came out of Hugging Face. It was parallel to the efforts that was going on in PyTorch.
Right.
But with Hugging Face now, if you for most known like well known models, if you want to download them. Sure, you can download the checkpoints, the PyTorch checkpoints if you want, but there is also the possibility for you to download the SafeTensor format.
Yes.
I think Transformers by default, the library, does download safe
it is
transfers.
It is also my understanding it's a default these days, and that's like and I remember back in the day, Keras, I think it might be because Keras was built in TensorFlow, they also had this format where, because it's a neural network is really just a bunch of floating point numbers in a NumPy array, if you think about it. So a Keras model was just a JSON file that said these are the shapes and how the layers are connected, and the rest are just binary NumPy files. That also felt like a relatively safe option. But yeah, neural networks, they are kind of simple in that regard. They're really just floating point numbers, and stuff in scikit-learn could really be a whole bunch of stuff.
That's true. It is a lot easier to, in terms of the, if the problem at hand is how do I persist a model, it is a much easier problem to persist neural network models because you have your architecture and then you have your weights.
And you go, And I also remember my previous employer, Explosion, they have a tool called Spacey. They took a very principled stance in the beginning where they also took this serialization pretty seriously. They have a whole stack of tools to sort of make it very clear that once you download this thing on disk, that it's also pretty safe. There's not really a whole lot of kerfuffle. But it was a very big and conscious effort and design decision that also, in the end, makes Spacey very different than most other Python libraries, which was also, it definitely had upsides, but it also had this downside of you got to educate people a bit. It sounds like this scikit-ops tool is definitely still useful, but then there are still like some challenges left. I think we briefly just mentioned sort of the educational aspect of it. Would you argue that that's like still one of the bigger things that's kind of hard about it? Or are there other concerns you're also still sort of... I don't know if it keeps you up at night. Probably not, but...
So the educational aspect is certainly there. And just a few days ago, we completely revamped our persistence page on the scikit-learn side.
So the old scikit-learn docs, which I think would still mention the joblib dump and load, got revamped sort of point to scikit-ops now. That's a recent change.
Well, so the way it is now is the first thing it mentions is if what you want to do with your persisted model is to get predictions out of it, and it is a standard scikit-learn thingy, you might consider Onyx, which is O-N-N-X. Originally, it was a deep learning kind of format to persist models, but it's a Turing-complete thing, so you can represent any arbitrary computation in it, which means you can represent any statistical machine learning model's prediction pretty easily in that format. And there is an sklearn Onyx library that converts most scikit-learn models into that format.
It doesn't have every, by the way. Like, I did play with it. There are some edge cases still, like in particular that function transformer, and it's not going to be 100% perfect, but it does support a whole bunch. Like that.
Yes.
It feels like an 80-20 rule kind of a thing. It does feel like it's got the 80% of it.
Yeah. And if the way that documentation now goes is if it supports you, and if the only thing you want to do is to get predictions, and you know how to deal with Onyx runtime, go with that, because getting predictions would also mean that you don't need an environment that even has Python installed in it. You just get Onyx runtime. It's like a pretty low footprint. It takes even less RAM. You load your model, you get predictions. Then the next step is if you don't really trust your source, but you want the Python object back, you might look into scops.io. That is then the second recommendation. But then if scops.io does not support you, you might look into joblib, pickle, and cloud pickle.
Yeah, while being aware of these downsides and take that serious. Yeah.
So that is now our new official recommendation documentation there. It is a good point that we should probably also maybe write something on the joblib side itself.
Probably also maybe. Yes, that's... we should talk to people. we should probably also maybe talk to people. All right, fair enough. There's a funny anecdote on my side now that I'm just reminded of. Like, it's a bit of a running joke at this point, but I'm proudly well known for the fact that I really try to solve everything with a linear model first. Like, that's something that's true. Try to do.
I love that about you.
it's a thing that I do. Like, and of course, I don't think you should use a linear model for everything, but it's just the Vincent benchmark that I run. Like, if your model doesn't outperform a linear model, then why would you? It's kind of a thing. So at some point, I wrote a little library called IcePickle that really just converts the linear model. because that's kind of a funny thing about linear models in scikit-learn. There's two things you got to save, the intercept and the coefficients. And those are the only two things you got to save into a binary array. And if you only support linear models, oh man, life is pretty easy. So that was a thing. I wrote that in a few hours, and that covered a whole bunch of use cases that I've got, because a lot of the text classification stuff I did has stateless transformers, and linear models was all I needed. But yeah, linear models are kind of like cheating, because those are like definitely the easy things out there. It does become like a whole lot trickier once you go into sort of the more fancy stuff out there.
So yeah, one thing. Yeah. There's also like related to that, another thing that we are thinking about, it would be a huge effort, is which the community clearly wants, but it is really hard to implement, and that's why we have not done that yet, is being able to load a model with a newer scikit-learn version, but you did your training with an older version.
Ooh, yeah, that's going to be super hard with pickles.
Nothing to do with how you persist your model. It has to do with the fact that because statistical models are arbitrary code in a sense, mm-hmm. we change a lot of internals there. And then now I save my object. And let's say like this is something that we genuinely did recently. We moved, in order to be more consistent with our loss functions, we created a new module for our losses. We moved a lot of things there. They are really nicely implemented there. And a lot of our modules now use that. Which means before, in a previous scikit-learn version, I would have a pointer to an object that lives in a place in the library that doesn't exist anymore. Now, if I want to load that model, it literally fails with an import error because that doesn't exist anymore.
Do you also maybe have some of this stuff when you're dealing with like Windows and Ubuntu, like cross-compatibility issues there as well? Would that also be...
Luckily, moving across operating systems is a no-brainer. The issue sometimes is when you move architectures. Like you are a 64-bit architecture,
oh, right.
You train on a 64-bit, you load on 32-bit. We are pretty good at it. As in, we do the extra effort in our set state when we are trying to load the model to kind of convert things into the architecture at hand. There are no guarantees, but so far, whenever we've gotten an issue, we have fixed it, but it is not something that we test for extensively.
Yeah, that I can imagine. Oh, okay, but we're also kind of in the looking for edge cases territory in a way here as well, I suppose. But I can definitely also imagine
because
that
you have it's not edge case at all, because when you are training, you have a massive machine, and when you want to load, you might want to have something that you can load in an embedded device that does some decision making on the embedded device.
Ah, that's also the use case here. Okay, yeah, that I can imagine is actually not that out there. A bunch of people want that for sure. Interesting though. So this also opens up another interesting thing, which suddenly, if you want to be able to save a model, a lot of that also depends on how you train and how you intend to use it. It's not necessarily it's not use case independent, this one.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's why. It's like the documentation is like, what do you want to do? Like the first question is like, if you ask me, how should I save my model? My question back would be, what do you want to do? Why are you saving your model?
So this kind of moves us into another sort of direction I was planning on talking about. So I'm going to do a small little bit of a pivot here, but it does feel that you are taking a lot of time to write a tool that makes an improvement, and that's great. But maybe the educational part is actually sort of the harder bit. Like, if you want to do this well, you got to update the scikit-learn docs. And updating the scikit-learn docs is great, but you don't just undo the last 10 years of documentation. Like, all the blogs will have copied from it. OpenAI will have trained on it, right? So there's all sorts of old practices that at some point have to be replaced by new ones. Reference to community, because new ideas came in through new community members and, world needs to move forward. But what does it take for old practices to be replaced by new ones? That's kind of an interesting question here. I wonder if you've got a perspective on this as a maintainer.
I mean, you mentioned OpenAI. I'm at a pickle there. I gave a talk last year at PyData Amsterdam about this topic. I quite liked that one. And we know that these companies that are creating these massive models, they get data from out there, like everything on YouTube, everything on whatever podcast probably they can get their hands on.
Yeah, anything they can download and get from under the kitchen sink, they will suck it in and do stuff with. Yeah. Yes.
Then I personally don't know. I do want those models to switch from Joblib to Scops. Mm-hmm. But that means that the content that I'm creating needs to go and be used as training material for those models. That is the way that that's going to happen. But how do I feel about everything that I'm producing being used for those models and then those companies getting revenue out of those models without me getting anything back from it?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is this interesting thing where there are these interesting things where sometimes there can be companies who make more money from training you to use a certain technology than money that they actually make implementing the technology. So I know a lot of people who do scikit-learn education, right? And that's fine. But they don't necessarily write scikit-learn in production. There's like an education industry there in a way. And to some extent, there's no stopping it. It's open source, so we're not going to sort of stop anyone. But there is this interesting thing where you do want to maybe make sure that they teach the right lessons and that they're all up to date in a way. Yes. And it will be nice if there's kind of like a two-way street there where if you're going to be properly training these things, it will be nice if you're somewhat in touch with the community.
That's true.
As well.
That is a good aspect too. Yeah.
That's but yeah, the question remains, like, what does it take for old practices to be replaced by new ones? I guess what you can do is update documentation. What you can do is do conference talks. Those are things that you can do.
This podcast.
And you can start a podcast and try to be funny enough so people will listen. That's also like a lever you can pull. But in the end, it's still also very much a community thing. That's also like an interesting thing I'm reminded of as I'm sort of having this conversation. Like you're only going to get there if you're communicating. That's the verb.
But so it has right now, as of now, I think the download, it doesn't really show much. But it is an indicator. The number of downloads from PyPI is about 1,500, 2,000 per day from Scops. I'm quite happy about that. Like,
that's
people
not
using
nothing,
it.
Right?
Yeah. It's nothing compared to scikit-learn, which is, I don't know, 9 million a week or so.
Yeah, it's about a million a day-ish.
Yeah. So it could definitely be a lot more. But I am excited for some of the things we are going to do with Scops that will probably make people more aware of the whole tool. And they will probably like come to this part of it as well. Like you mentioned that like the main part that we are most proud of in Scops right now is the persistence. But there is also the model card aspect. There is like model documentation, inspection, interpretation, all of those aspects. You do have some tools in scikit-learn itself. You do have a little bit of tooling in Scops. You do have, if you care about responsible AI, you do have things in like libraries like Fairlearn. But it isn't, all of that is not very well integrated together yet. And we are moving forward with that. And I'm very excited that we have a colleague joining this week who will be focusing just on that front.
Yeah, and not to promise anything, but we've talked about this. Like the overarching dream would be something like, you know, I've got my choice of model here and like the grid search, and I've got my data sets that I'm training on. You hit a button and then you just get this report card that other people can just sort of look at and read and judge. There's doing that manually is a whole lot of work, and you're never going to get it perfectly. Like I do think some manual work for some specific use cases can totally make sense. But right now, it does feel like there's too much manual work. And that's something that is being worked on right now.
Very much.
Cool. So we are sort of getting closer and closer to the end of this little talking session. And, you know, you just mentioned something that you're very excited about SKOps. And, you know, solid feature. Looking forward to that. That definitely makes a lot of sense. One thing I am kind of curious about, like, a little bit more broadly, because, again, I'm talking to someone who has the scikit-learn maintainer's perspective. What are some other things you're just sort of seeing over the horizon that you think are just kind of cool for like the ecosystem at large? Are there any other things that you maybe don't see happen tomorrow, but like in the somewhat near term future where you do kind of go like, all right, let's get some more attention to that. Because again, there are new practices that we're going to have to move towards? Maybe there are some directions that people should start having a look at.
Nothing that exists as of now, but one thing I am excited about related to all of this, like Gen AI hype, is what would it take to have a virtual assistant that would make you do sane statistical machine learning and implement all the best practices? It would definitely take a lot of effort to implement that. But once we have it, I feel like that can scale a lot better than me giving a talk in a conference or trying to convince somebody who teaches scikit-learn to mention the good practices. I say that because I see so many people using these Gen AI tools. I have talked to people who would outright say they would think twice before hiring somebody at this point who does not use these tools, which I found very interesting. I'd like, as an old grumpy guy, maybe I would maybe be on the opposite side, but I'm like more and more warming up to the idea that maybe there is like a lot of use to those tools. I definitely see a lot of people who are learning a new part of the tech using these tools a lot, and it really does help them. I see a lot of more junior people who are entering the ecosystem, and they use these tools to either get explanations from the code that we wrote, I don't know, 5 years ago, good luck trying to figure out what the code does. But the machine at this point has gotten pretty good at explaining what the code does. So I'm at this point, I'm cautiously optimistic on that part of the tech coming out.
There is, so my experience with these tools have been a little bit hit or miss. Like I do like the part where you don't have to be a rock star in syntax anymore in order to be productive. Like I think in the beginning of my career, I got a lot of mileage out of just knowing the Pandas API from the top of my head, and I could just sort of bang away at the keyboard. And right now it's going to pivot maybe a little bit more towards not writing the syntax, but being able to debug it. And sort of that requires a bit of a difference, maybe deeper understanding of what the thing is supposed to do. And I do think it would be good if that's more the focus. So I don't have to worry so much about how do I call this one model in scikit-learn, but that I can be a little bit more focused on why would this model make the most sense for this particular data set. And that's more of a question that I spend my day-to-day on. If I'm going to build the simplest chatbot for that, it would really just repeat the question, did you try a linear model first? Like, I do think version zero of that bot might be simpler than you think, but...
I feel like it's equivalent to the IT service, have you tried turning it off and on again? Vincent is, have you tried the linear model yet?
Vincent as a service is basically a bot saying, did you try a linear model yet? But it is going to be interesting to see. Like, the one thing I do still worry about a little bit is also, like, if you do it wrong in this realm, like, if you do something right, let's say you get one cool point, but then you do something wrong and then you have to deduct 20 cool points. Like, that's kind of what's the balance there. And the other day, just to give, like, a example, I was using, I won't name the company, but somewhat state-of-the-art, and they are popular on Twitter. I was using their tool to build something in Slack, and I was asking for a CSRF token. Like, I want to secure my forms online. And what you can do is you can add like a CSRF token. And if you do that the right way, then some tomfoolery on your forms is not going to happen. And the bot would very gladly tell me like, yeah, okay, here's how you generate a CSRF token. Random.randint, and then you generate a random integer and that you can put as a CSRF token. Now, one worry I do have is you're laughing. So I think we're both in on the joke. Like, if you want to do this securely, you have to use a secure hashing like algorithm, something with more entropy, because there's definitely ways to break this. And if you've taken a course in security, you would have known this. But if the bot starts recommending you to do it this way, right, like that, that's where harm can also come in. So that's the balance we're still trying to unravel as a community, I guess. Like, how can we prevent that one thing, but still have people sign on and not have to worry about a virtual env in order for them to write Python code? Like, that, there's stuff like that where I think there's a lot of cool.
That's why I think... things that get repeated a lot, easy stuff, boilerplate stuff, beginner stuff, are really good for these bots. But and as soon as it gets more advanced, I wouldn't trust anything to get in my code base automated without manually looking at it.
Especially if it contains pickles.
Yes.
So yeah, and that's going to be part of the challenge, I think. Like, how can we make sure that the new practice actually gets in there? That's going to be interesting to see.
That's true. I feel like there is a lot of automation coming, and we might need to work on automating a lot of these auditing that we've been doing manually as well. And that does sound exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
It means like less boring work, more exciting work.
Oh, I hope so. it can go in all sorts of directions, but that's like a topic for another podcast. Having said that, I do want to thank you for joining in on this one. For people at home, I guess SK Ops, check it out if you haven't already. Do read the docs. Like, you have to understand it to sort of benefit from it. If people have questions, Adrian, what's the best place where they can find you? I think you're probably still on GitHub these days.
Yes, I'm on GitHub and on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn, social media. There we go. Adrian, thanks again for coming. And see. Well, and we're colleagues, so we're going to see each other on Slack. Yes. In a bit. But everyone at home, thanks for listening, and see you on the next one. So thanks for listening to this episode of Sample Space. We like to think that right now there's a nice little cadence going. But as always, we are definitely still interested in getting community feedback. If there are some guests that you think we should consider, you can definitely reach out. But we're also eager to hear any feedback in general. You may have seen our YouTube channel where we post some educational content. And if you have any ideas on that as well, definitely feel free to reach out to us, either on LinkedIn or on YouTube. We're definitely eager to hear what you might have to say. Having said that, once again, thanks for listening.